Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Consider the politics of motherhood. That's how Gloria Steinem addressed the graduating women at Smith College back in 1971. Isn't it interesting, she said, that motherhood becomes sacred, that the Madonna image is prevalent whenever the state needs workers and the state needs soldiers. Sex in human beings, she went on, has never been as directly related to conception as it is in animals. So perhaps God, perhaps she, had something else in mind for us. Well, let's think about this. Even back in the early 1970s, girls didn't get pregnant. They got in trouble. Mothers who did work likely wore skirts and worked for men. They were nurses and secretaries and stewardesses. And the Gloria Steinem feminists of that era can rightfully claim to have changed life for all of us, boys, girls, men, and women. So much so, though, that the next generation of feminists, those who call themselves the Third Wave, have a few issues to discuss with their mothers. Connection listeners, is there a simple explanation here that daughters will always want to fight or disagree with their mothers, or is there something else at play? How did the feminist movement of the 60s and the 70s change notions of motherhood? And how are the economic realities of our everyday lives shaping motherhood today? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're joined on the program today by Suzanne Braun-Levine. She was the managing editor of Ms. Magazine for 16 years. She won a Peabody Award for her HBO feature on the history of American women in the 20th century. And she's just finished a new book. It's called A Woman's Guide to Second Adulthood, Your Brain, Your Power, Your Prospect. She's in our New York studio alongside Amy Richards. Amy is a co-author of the book Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism in the Future. She's also the Amy behind Ask Amy at Feminist.com and a co-founder of the nonprofit organization for young women called the Third Wave Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Amy, I want to start with you. You make the point in your book, Manifesta, that you were born in 1970, which means you were barely on your pins when Gloria Steinem made that address to the women at Smith College. Now, you've worked with her since, and I'm just wondering, listening to what she said back in 71, how would you edit her? How would you say, well, Gloria, I respectfully agree or disagree with what she was saying?
Well, I respect Gloria is entitled to opinion on everything, and I think Gloria probably evolved on this topic as well over 30-plus years, not so much because we as individuals have changed, but the state of motherhood has changed. In 1970, or thereabouts, 69, 68, it wasn't so much a choice for women. It was a role that they had to assume. And what my generation has luckily been able to do is to determine what role it's going to have in our lives, if it's going to have any role in our life. There are many young women who are able to say, I don't want to have kids. I don't want to adopt them. I don't want to have them in my life. And they're free to do that. And there's also women who are free to say, I want to be a stay-at-home mother. Mm-hmm. And there's also young women who are free to come up with some alternative solution. I'm going to work part-time. And in part, that's because the workplace has changed and afforded some people that opportunity. But it's because of feminism, because feminism said this is something women don't have to do, but should be able to choose to do.
And Suzanne, at the time when you were fighting that battle, was there did you think at the time that someone like Amy would come along and say, in fact, you guys did such a good job that now we get to make some other choices here?
Well, I think what we were struggling with was not only the circumstances, but our own feelings about those circumstances. In the same way that the young women today are struggling with their reaction to what kind of mothers we were very close to women who were frustrated and had not the opportunity to pursue their talents and their interests. I think of my own mother, who I am beginning to reconsider now. I never took her interests, her talents, her commitments very seriously either, because she didn't and because the circumstances didn't. Now young women are looking at mothers who are very active, dynamic, committed, who take care of business in the outside world, who take care of business at home, who take care of their own business. And I think that's, although I understand how disappointed they may have been that their mothers weren't there all the time for them, I think that the role models that we have given them have made it possible for them to take everything one step further and find yet more ways of mixing and matching work, family, children, no children, that there are unlimited permutations, and it's very exciting to see them opening up.
There's a description of the first wave feminists back in the, you know, starting in the 1840s up to the early part of the 20th century as women who were outward looking, talking to the men. And then there's a second description, Suzanne, of the second wave feminists who were inward looking, in fact, talking to the women, talking amongst themselves. I don't know whether or not you agree with that, but take it one step for me beyond that, Amy and Suzanne both. What's the conversation now between third wave and second wave? Is it still women trying to sort it out with other women, or has the scope of the conversation changed?
I think the conversation has entirely changed. I think that feminism wrongly, of the feminism of the 70s, inherited a reputation of being anti-male, and that was because it somehow got confused that women only meant anti-male, and those two things actually mean very different things. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a need in the 70s to create women-only spaces, whether that was a consciousness-raising group or an organization that funded only women or a program area or a legislation, whatever it was. I think today we realize that we need men not only as allies, but we need them to be feminists on their own, for their own sake. It's not that we want them to be shared parents, for instance, because that's going to make women's life easier, but it's going to make their life better and more complete. And so I think that that conversation has changed, but it's not one that third wave has. It's an evolution of feminism is the only reason that we're able to have it today.
Well, I think we tend to forget how mixed up and confused we all were when we began to deal with these issues. Betty Friedan called the problem that has no name back in 1963. And you have to remember that women were sitting in the middle of their lives wondering why they weren't as happy as they were supposed to be. And it took a very long time to begin to open up to each other, to begin to compare notes, to begin to admit that we were angry or confused or felt like failures. So the period in which women were talking to women was a very necessary first step. I think Amy's absolutely right that once things began to make a little more sense and once women began to make breakthroughs in areas that were important, the conversation had a vocabulary and it could open up. I think one of the important things that's happened in terms of men is that we've all become to realize that there really are two steps to this process. One is that women break free of the very restrictive domestic image that was imposed on them. And the other is that men break free of the very work-a-day, stiff upper lip, the whole macho thing, and work their way back into the domestic, family-loving, messy side of life. And I see that more and more. I wrote a book a few years ago called Father Courage, What Happens When Men Put Family First. And at that time, a man who was seen in the park with a child was suspected of being a molester. Nowadays, I walk by parks and there are little clusters of men comparing notes, taking care of each other's children while one does something else. And there's a much more engaged feeling about between men and children, I think, that is miraculous, has happened miraculously quickly. So I think we're all in this together and beginning to have that kind of a conversation.
I think we're also starting to have the conversation among different generations with our mothers and with our daughters. And I think, you know, Suzanne, when you were talking about the 70s, it was mostly having it among your peers saying, are you experiencing this? And I know with a lot of my friends who did not have working mothers or mothers who worked outside the home, there was this invisibility that happened to them. And especially now as my friends have jobs and are putting mortgages, getting mortgages and buying cars, getting health insurance, the person they turn to is their father because they see that role that he played, which was making these decisions, not their mother. And the mother, historically, I think, would become bitter about that invisibility. But the conversation is opened in that way, too, saying, why is it that you ask your father this? You know, why don't you see me as an equal partner in this or having made equal decisions with him? Or, in fact, maybe the one who researched all of that and figured out how to get a mortgage and how to buy a car.
So what's the knock, Amy? I mean, what's the knock that a third wave feminist would have against her mother? Where's the tension in the conversation that you hear?
Well, it depends on what type of mother you had. You know, I had a working mother who always worked outside the home, but I never felt like she was not there for me. I have other friends.
She was a single mom too, right?
Yeah, and I've never known my father.
Okay.
I have other friends who had a similar situation, but who felt that their mother's work was a priority over them as an individual. And they're very resentful of their mother for making that choice and therefore are making different choices. They're choosing not to go to work. I have other friends who identify with the invisibility of their mother and who are saying, I'm never going to allow myself to fall into that trap. So I think it depends on what kind of mother you had. And my generation, because we grew up right when kind of feminism was peaking, some of us have mothers that were, you know, 100% feminist at the marches reading Ms. Magazine, and others of us have 100% conventional mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have both of those going on in my generation.
And Suzanne, is there resentment among among your generation at people who will say, nah, I'm going to stay home. Thanks for the help.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. I had a conversation recently where somebody suggested something I hadn't thought of, but I think may be true, which is that we may have overemphasized the liberating power of work, as if getting a job, getting out there, getting your share of the system and getting equal pay for it was the only way to find expression for who you were besides being a woman and a mother. And I think maybe a lot of these young women are picking up a little of that fanaticism, which was inevitable because the struggle was so hard. But the message may have been that the only way to maintain your self-respect is to get out there and get a high-power, intense job that you think about around the clock. But the other thing is that there is, and here's something that I think we have to get ourselves away from, which is thinking of young women that we work with as our daughters. I know Amy agrees with me, that we complicate things by assuming all young women are our daughters and therefore should be inheriting our agenda, our interests, our commitment, and that because we are their mothers, we know what's good for them. I think there's a lot of tension because of that, the misuse of those names.
We want to start just at that point when we come back after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, a conversation about motherhood in the days before Mother's Day, as we look at the way different generations are regarding it, particularly with the economic stress forcing two-income families and all the pressures on women today to be gorgeous, have the wonderful career, raise three kids, and don't forget we're having friends over for dinner. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about some changing perceptions of motherhood on our program today with Amy Richards. Amy's co-founder of the Third Wave Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization that provides money and support to young women. She's co-author of a book called Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. And she's in our New York studio with Suzanne Braun-Levine, who was managing editor of the Feminist Ms. Magazine for 16 years and was executive producer of an HBO special, She's Nobody's Baby, A History of American Women in the 20th Century, which won her a Peabody Award for Journalism, the highest award that you can get for that kind of work. And Amy, let me ask you to respond to what Suzanne was saying just before the break about this overemphasis on the importance of work. Were you sort of nodding your head? There were a few heads nodding.
Well, it's interesting because I have recently become fascinated by this. I'm in my early 30s, and most of my friends and peer group are obviously in that same age range. So we're right kind of in this moment of that family career moment. And I went to an all-women's college, Barnard College, and every time I get the alumni newsletter, I'm always reading, you know, where women are in my class. And one of the fascinating things I think about my peer group is that the ones who wanted to be the next Katie Couric, the next Barbara Walters, you know, the next Ann Richards, are the ones who now in their early 30s want to be stay-at-home moms more than anybody else. And it was the ones who had their eye so much on that point of success who feel like, oh, wait, I'm 30 and I haven't reached that yet, so I'll just be a stay-at-home mom because that's something I can be successful at. And it's interesting because I think the women who did not necessarily say, I'm going to be the top of my field, but I'm going to find something that I find interesting and I'm going to make that a valuable part of my life and I'm going to be good at it.
But does that choice mean that the friend, the woman that you're talking about, has to say at some point, I failed in my career because she's not managing editor of Ms. Magazine?
Yeah, I don't think the word failure comes up, but I think it's I've reevaluated my goals and I no longer want that because the price of success in that high of a way feels like a compromise. You know, you can't have a balance as easily at that level that you can when you're in a middle management. And there are tons of studies that show that when you ask women about, you know, climbing the corporate ladder, what they would prefer at a certain point is to plateau and to exchange the advancement in that traditional hierarchical way for, can I have my advancement in the form of a day off a week or 2 days off a week? Because they want to have that balance. And so I do agree with Suzanne that there was too much of an emphasis on not only that you have to work, but that you have to be really successful. And there is kind of a limit on what success is for each individual.
Isn't it still a situation where you're describing motherhood as the second option rather than the first to work?
I think so. I mean, I live in New York City. I'm, you know, white, I'm privileged, I went to, you know, so some of it might be my particular experience, but that is my experience.
But, you know, Amy mentioned balance and plateaus. And I think one of the things that her generation is going to be able to do is to introduce those concepts into the workplace in a better way than we could. One of the areas of conflict between us often is maternity leave. The Medical and Family Leave Act was one of the biggest deals of our feminist experience.
Started out as pregnancy leave. Do you remember that, Suzanne?
That's
it was like
right.
6 weeks
disability.
Off.
That's right. Right, and you lay in bed in a bed jacket. But it was a big fight, and it was very important. One of the main arguments that women made to employers was, if you give us this time off, we will come back raring to go. We'll be better employees than we ever were. We'll work harder, we'll work better, we'll be more loyal. Now Amy's generation is coming back and saying, you know, that 6 weeks was great, but in order to make my life work, I only want to come back for 3 days or 4 days. And I know that one of the areas of tension between women my age and Amy's age is that we say, how can you do that? You're undermining the main argument that we made in order to get this important privilege. They're saying it's too restrictive, and men and women have to have more room for their lives in their work lives. And I think that we're going to move further towards that on the efforts of young women who are making more nuanced decisions and have the power and the self-confidence to not say thank you for my maternity leave, but I want to renegotiate it. And I think that's terrific.
And the interesting thing is that, I mean, it's actually called family leave, and men are entitled to it too.
Right, but parental leave.
And I've talked to, you know, men who work in companies that have these policies in place, because it only applies to companies that have more than 50 employees. So we're talking about a limited people that this is even available to. But they say that there's such a stigma against men taking it. So we need those very senior men, you know, in the same way that I talked to friends of mine who work at places like Bernstein's and Deloitte and Touche, and they have to see how the females ahead of them dress, and if they wear pants, it's okay for them to wear pants. We need for men to be in those senior positions and take parental leave or the paternal leave, so then the younger men in the office can say, oh, it's okay for me to do that too.
Let's go to our calls. We've got Karen joining us on the line from Southborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you for calling.
My comment is, I'm a 40-year-old woman, and I have two children, and I run a business. I find that in my life, I have to do everything. I have to make the money, I have to raise the children, and I think that more burdens have been added on to women as far as we're expected to do everything now.
I mean, one of the really big changes, Karen, between 1971 and now seems to me that there's an expectation that each family that has two parents in it, both parents will be working.
Right.
And that's not just for fulfillment, that's to get by.
Right, and that's why we do it. But I find that because I run my own business and I have more time, everything seems to fall on me. And I look at all my friends and I see that that's the situation that they're in also, that the women are the ones that bear the burden of everything.
So you look back to Gloria Steinem and Bela Abzug and Germaine Greer and you say, well, thanks for nothing.
Not for nothing. We have a lot more choices now.
Obviously.
But it just seems like we have a lot more work also.
I have friends who are in mother's groups, and the three most common topics that come up, regardless, and these come from friends all over the country, are how do I deal with my mother-in-law, how do I go back to work, and how do I balance this, and how do I get my husband to change more diapers, or the father of my child to change more diapers.
But you know, that it's interesting in terms of sharing parenting, which is the term that we all use. I've come to believe that men don't really understand what we mean by that. For a woman, parenting is nurturing the children, understanding their problems, taking them to the doctor, but also doing the laundry, getting glue for a school project, cleaning up after whatever. A man seems to think of parenting as only the time spent with a child, so that if a man says to his wife, I'm a co-parent because I spend the same amount of time with the children that you do. But the whole arena of household tasks and all that shit work that seems to burden us more than anything else is out of the realm of the area that women and men seem to be trying to establish equality in. And a lot of women get frustrated. They feel their husbands aren't doing their share. And the men get frustrated because they feel they're not being appreciated. So this whole revolution is so interesting. It's about opening up areas to talk about and finding terminology for so we can express what our reactions are. And I think this is an area that we haven't really found the words for yet.
Well, it's that not only do they help in the tasks, but how do you come up with a list of what tasks need to be done?
Yeah, there have been studies where men, audiences of men have been asked to raise their hands if they do the grocery shopping, and a whole, like, 90% go up. And then they say, and who makes the list? And no hands go up. So I think Amy's right. That's a good test.
All right. Karen, thanks for that. Let's go next to Philadelphia. And Ariel's joining us. Hi, Ariel.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was calling because I'd like your speakers to address an issue that I'm really familiar with. I'm in my mid-20s. I have two small children. And, you know, as a young mother, I think that there's a lot of sort of disparaging of young mothers who are under 30. And especially that you would sort of the choice to have kids at such a young age would be somewhat uneducated. And I think at least in my case, that couldn't be further from the truth for me. I went to an Ivy League school, you know, and I have worked and things like that. But in the end, you know, I decided that while my children were small, it would be a good time to sort of spend time with them and things like that, giving me enough time in my 30s to go and really sort of start a career full-fledged. And I was wondering if
it's like you can't win. You get judged whether you do it early. You get judged if you do it too late.
Exactly. Well, I mean, And also added to this is that, you know, I am biracial, black and Mexican, and I walk through the streets and people have this, you know, thought that whenever you see a young minority parent, that they are poor and struggling and all of the rest, which is couldn't be further from the truth, for me at least.
Or the nanny.
Exactly, or the nanny. So I was wondering if your speakers could sort of address that issue.
Well, Ariel, I was listening to you and I was thinking, you know, I'm in my 30s. I'm 33 and I'm pregnant, and people think I'm making a choice later in life. You know, so it is this, you know, exactly what Dick said. It's a no-win situation. You're either too young or you're too old. And I do think it's funny that unwanted always goes with teenage pregnancy.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of, you can't just say teenage pregnancy. It's an unwanted teenage pregnancy.
Well, and I wanted to say was that it's interesting that at least in my family, all of my female relatives have had their children early on. So by the time that they were in their 30s, they really had a chance to sort of begin a new life. And I always thought that that was the best way to do it. But, you know, as I know people who are in their 30s and in their 40s and who really feel so much struggle to sort of have a child and also keep a career going that they have had going. And so I think that that's sort of also an issue that you have in motherhood nowadays. You know, that I wanted you to address also, if you could.
Well, I mean, this is not unique to mothers. I think in this generation, we no longer have careers the way we once did. I mean, historically, it was you graduated from college and you got your job at Kodak or Polaroid or GE, and you stayed in that job until your retirement. And that's not something that exists anymore. Nobody has that. And so I think it's more that has freed up women to have multiple careers. And I know Suzanne's book that she just finished writing deals with that, kind of addressing the audience of 50 up, is that correct? But I think that's something that I'm noticing in a lot of my friends, is that they take off those years from, I mean, and again, it's a great place to be that you can take off those 5 years while your kids are not in school, and then they go back and find themselves in another career at that time. And I think that that's hopefully something that workplaces can keep open to, because historically the problem has been the minute women take them out themselves out of the workplace or out of that track, they aren't able to get back on it.
Suzanne, in the at the time when you were editing Ms. And in the 60s and the 70s, there were the, I'll use the word extreme feminists, who were sort of, I'm not going to have children, we're busy with other things right now. But I'm not sure that the stigma that Ariel's describing, that Amy's talking about having children when you're in your 20s or children in your 30s, or, oh, my gosh, waiting till I'm in my... I mean, there wasn't as much stigma attached to that then, was there? There weren't women above you, beneath you, older, younger, saying, this is the wrong time, this is the wrong time. You know what I mean? It seems to me that that's almost backing up.
Well, it's interesting. You know, so many of the sentences that we've begun in this and answering this question have been should and don't and won't. We're still struggling with imposed expectations, and specifically in the area of motherhood. For lots of reasons, everybody seems to feel that there ought to be some right way to do it. And I think the early feminist movement got a lot of flack for appearing to be anti-motherhood, to be unsympathetic to the experiences of women who stayed home. And no matter how hard we tried in Ms. Magazine to counteract that, I know we didn't succeed. And I think one of the reasons was the sort of catch-22 of the fact that the women who were out there working on the issues of feminism, working at Ms. Magazine, were not at home and had struggled very hard to break those rules. And I think it became hard to be totally empathetic with that experience. So I think that is a kind of a piece of the story that hasn't been explored as fully as a lot of young women might benefit from.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Amy, is there one age that doesn't attract this sort of
finger wagging?
No, but one of the things I was thinking of, I mean, I don't know if this is Ariel's situation, but one of the things I also think is very threatening for women of any age, but young women in particular, is giving up their power. And that is still primarily in the home. I think that traditionally men have had power outside of the home in the workplace, and women have had the power over the home, the decisions that get made about the children, about children's schooling, about their daycare, who their doctors are going to be. And I think that some of this emphasis now on co-parenting is there's a resistance from women because we don't yet have equal power outside of the house, and so we're not yet willing to give up our power inside of the house. And so I don't want to exempt women from any responsibility in this. I do think that there's a reason. But I think that the point is not to blame the individual for making that choice, but society for still not allowing us to make
But aren't you then becoming the same, or sort of inheriting the same martyr mom complex that you write about
yeah.
in your book?
No, definitely. I mean, because, I mean, I don't, I mean, I'm a, we'll see when I'm a mother how I play this out in my own personal life, but in a movement sense, I think so. I think that what we have to be careful of as young women is, it's just putting the blame where it needs to be. And I think sometimes what we tend to do is we tend to blame individuals when it's not an individual problem, mm-hmm. it's a systemic problem. And we need to change that. I mean, it's we can't look at women who stay home and judge them or women who go to the workplace and say, you're abandoning your children. But why is it that we're put in this position? I mean, I was at a breakfast this morning and Ann Richards was the keynote speaker. And she said, you know, we spend all of our time vilifying poor women for staying home with their kids and not going to work. And we spend the rest of our time vilifying middle class women for going to work and not staying home with their kids. It's like you can't win.
No, there's also another aspect of staying at home with your kids. My kids are teenagers. And I've begun to think that we shouldn't only focus on staying home with your kids when they're little. That in terms of family life, teenage time might be a whole lot of a better time to be there watching what's going on and staying plugged into your kids.
We have to take a short break. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that afterwards. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. We're talking about feminism and motherhood this hour. With me on the program from our studios in New York City, Suzanne Braun Levine and Amy Richards, feminists of different generations. And our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Straight back to the lines now. And Carborough, North Carolina, Karen's with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Something one of the guests said earlier touched on something for me as a black woman. I'm mid-30s, and I'm actually finding myself in graduate school again. And when it comes to this idea of power and feeling empowered, the sort of mother-daughter relationship between black women can be really confining. And the caller mentioned something about how older women and women who consider themselves feminist and black feminists assume that we take their agenda, and they also assume that as women entering a certain structure that we need to be empowered, and we need them particularly to feel empowered. And that's not necessarily true, and that can be very confining because in some ways their exercise of power in that system becomes a reproduction of white male patriarchal power. And it can become very disempowering. And you find women who you want to be allies with, even though you may disagree on some issues or want to be, or you're pursuing something different, will start working against you. And that's really frustrating and really disempowering and sad.
I want to make sure I understand this, Karen. The type of power that's exercised is there. It's being exercised as a male sort of suit and tie type power. Is that what?
This idea of I think if you look at black feminism in particular, and that's why I think this is a particular problem with a black feminist perspective, is there's this understanding of, okay, because of the intersections of race and gender, you're doubly marginalized, and so you really feel disempowered in any kind of dominant culture structure. And that's not necessarily true, especially if you're someone like me, who's grown up in, I have a middle class background, both my parents were professionals, I always had a sense of myself as a black person and a black woman, but I also had a sense of that didn't limit me. And even if people tried to tell me it limited me, I would resist that. And I don't necessarily need to feel personally empowered. I just need people to do their jobs and help me and maybe support me if I need it, but I don't necessarily need their control in a certain way. They finding that sometimes there's a certain understanding of what it means to be a black feminist, particularly.
I think it's exactly the same thing. Well, no, not exactly the same thing. But I think it's similar to what Amy and Suzanne were talking about when they were talking about the sort of ownership of a daughter by a mother. You know, the mm-hmm. whether it's parental or maternal or paternal or whatever it is, there is a maternalistic part of that. Was it your book where I was reading about get away from this, be colleagues, don't be generationally different?
Well, I mean, what Karen, I think, is addressing is a much larger problem, which is that how feminists in the 70s identified success was accessing worlds that were previously shut off to them. And that was the same measure of success that the civil rights movement used. It was like, let's open up these avenues that weren't available to us. And so what happened is that women and non-white people were able to be in the workplace. And then when we go back to look at what has been successful about our movement, what we say is, oh, X number of women are CEOs, or X number of African-American men are now able to go to graduate school. And we measure it in these terms of how well we've integrated ourselves into a white, middle class, for the most part, you know, heterosexual world. And I think that as movements that have more radical underpinnings to them, we have to be more, I think, strategic about what our goal is. It's not how well we integrate ourselves into those environments, but how well we change those environments. Because I think the problem becomes then we look to the woman in that place, or we look to the gay person in the place to introduce partner benefits, you know, where it's the woman in the place. And then we turn on each other, because that's not what it's about. It's about both integrating, but having enough integration to the point that we can change those structures.
Well, I think Karen is also right about the assumption that the younger woman needs the help and support and nurturing of the older one. I think that's the problem with this mother-daughter thing. I think we are really much more strangers than we are willing to believe. And if we would start from that point of view, if women like Karen, who feel their power, were understood, if the starting line were, I have my power and you have your power, and how are we going to exercise it? And how can you help me? And how can I help you?
Right.
I think there'd be more room to maneuver.
Exactly, because what happens is, what I meant by reproducing this sort of patriarchal power is if you don't agree with them, or if you have a sense of their power and don't want to be saved by them, so I know that you are resisting them, and they can turn on you, and they can use their power that they've gained in that structure to actually disempower you.
You know what's interesting, Karen, is I'm thinking back to the 60s and the 70s when the white feminists that I knew used the word sister to talk to each other, to sort of, you know, level the ground. And I hear that word today more between black women than I do necessarily between white women. And I'm wondering whether or not it has kind of confining qualities rather than liberating qualities.
Yes, very much so. And it's because, like the guests were mentioning earlier about, there's this understanding of, okay, success is getting into the workplace. There's this sort of one identity of success. It's like, okay, there's one identity of a black feminist consciousness, you know, and it's like, well, no, that's not necessarily my identity as a black female. Maybe race is less central to me at some times. Sometimes I am more strategic about it. Or maybe I've been operating in a dominant environment, and so I know kind of how to pick my battles. What really is an issue of, okay, I feel marginalized as a black woman, or my voice is silenced, or this is something else, or it's just that sometimes I think the what's really frustrating is to feel like, okay, I do have a sense of myself as a black woman. It's not the same as yours, but it doesn't mean I don't respect that, and it doesn't mean you know, that I don't feel a need to resist. Sometimes I do, but not all the time, and maybe not in the same way that you do. And I think there is some resentment of if you don't feel like you need them all the time. And they call it, I know Patricia Hill Collins is a black feminist writer, she calls it the ethic of caring of the black woman. And it's like, well, sometimes though you can crush us with your caring.
All right, Karen, I want to move on. Thanks a lot for your call, though. To Fayetteville, North Carolina now. Jennifer's on the line. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I just wanted to say that I waited until I was in my 30s to have children. I was an Army officer for 9 years, and I always felt I could do whatever I wanted to do. My mother is a lawyer. She waited until she was in her 30s to go to law school, and I think we owe a tremendous debt to all those people who went before us.
And how's it working out?
Great.
I mean, in terms of doing whatever you want to do, are you still on with that?
I think so. I stay home with my son. I'm expecting another son soon. And I'm happy right now. I expect when I hit about 40, I'll probably go back to school and go back to work.
And what you're saying is that the option to serve in the Army is where you tip your hat to the feminist who came before you.
Sure. Totally.
And the decision to say after 9 years, time to be a mom, is more where you come in and say, I get to make these choices today.
Right, and nobody looks at me and says, oh, that's a bad decision. Or, you know, some people have said you can do it or not do it, and I know people who've stayed in and had children, but this was a good choice for me, and...
Jennifer, what about the people? What about the people and you know, they're your friends and my friends who are really stressed out trying to do both at the same time? Though, so be the mother and hang on to that job.
I think in most cases you really do have a choice. I think my family made financial sacrifices. I mean, we went from two pretty good incomes to one, but we found ways to make it work. And I think in a lot of cases, I mean, obviously single parents, it's another story.
Right.
But in a two-income family, I think you can make lifestyle choices. If you really want to stay home for 4 or 5 years, you can do it. I really think you can.
Suzanne, let me hear from you on that.
Okay.
Well, I'm so happy to hear from somebody who feels that they put the pieces together the way it works for them. I think that's... I only wish she had daughters.
One of the things both of the last two calls made me think of is this concept that my co-author, who's also named Jennifer, and I talk about in Manifesto, which is buying your own bad press. And I think that one of the things that we buy into is that there's only one way to do parenting. And I know that I've been in conversations with many of my friends, and they will say things like, well, I got married because I want to have kids. And then I'll kind of push this point a little bit and say, well, why do you have to be married in order to do that? And they say, oh, because, you know, children of single mothers just don't fare as well in society. And forgetting that I'm in this conversation and I think I fared pretty well. And I'm always the exception to the rule. And then similarly, I look around at all of my friends and I think there's an equal balance of those mothers who work and those mothers who stay home. And I wouldn't say that there's any pattern to the kids who are in the stay-at-home mom camp and those who are in the working parent camp. And that same goes for my friends now. I mean, you're equally dysfunctional if you had your parents stay home, or you're equally dysfunctional if your parent went to work. And I think that that's something that we really have to challenge ourselves to do, is to step out of these stereotypes. And I mean, it's similar to what Karen was saying about, we can't buy that we're oppressed. Nobody can make us feel disempowered. We have to kind of challenge all of these things that come to us, as we say in Manifesto, as received wisdom, and say, no, that's not the way it was for me. That doesn't have to be the way. And I think Jennifer's point now is that she's going to do it both, and that totally works for her, and it might not work for somebody else, but it's a great thing. And hopefully, you know, other people can make that choice and not feel judged by it and not feel limited by it, but rather feeling like I've made the best choice I can.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Suzanne, I'm wondering whether or not Amy's generation, in your view, has to take on the job of creating that level of choice for people at every income bracket. The idea that flex days aren't something in only those forward-looking companies, that parent leave, you know, could go from 6 weeks to 6 months under certain circumstances without somebody necessarily risking the loss of their job. I mean, you guys rolled the rocks a long way up the hill, but we're still talking about the types of choices which are available in large part only to the people who can afford them.
Well, that certainly would be the burden I would like to lay upon them. But I am aware that they are going to do things their way.
Right.
And one of the arguments, one of the complaints my generation frequently has about their generation is that they don't seem to be politically committed. They don't seem to be activists. They don't seem to be out there. And for a fact, they don't seem to be voting in the numbers that we voted. So we, you know, get impatient. But I do think that from their perspective, they are making change in a different way. They are gathering power and then using it in within the system to make the changes for themselves one by one that that accumulate and make a bigger change. Their style is different. I think their agenda in many ways is different. But I would hope that they take on the struggle to make work and family not such a hard combination.
Amy, let me hear from you. We're a little short for time.
Well, I was going to say the other thing that Suzanne's generation generally accuses my generation of is feeling entitled. And I think that what gets lost in this is that that entitlement is a result of the success of feminism. We shouldn't have to feel our oppression. We should be able to kind of wake up and say, oh, I'm entitled to do both of these things. Why should I have to compromise myself? And I think that young women, you know, like Jennifer, who are finding a way to make it work and do a little bit of everything, is a direct success of feminism because it both changed the individual to say that the emphasis isn't on what choice you make, but the freedom to make that choice. But the emphasis has also been on the workplace to change to allow that to happen.
Thanks to both of you for this. It's been fascinating listening in. Amy Richards, author of Manifesto Young Women, Feminism, and the Future, and Suzanne Braun-Levine, former managing editor of Ms. Magazine, now working as a writer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.